How you doing? Everybody full from breakfast? Ready to get a little sleep? I'm just kidding. I hope you're all warmed up a little bit. The last time I was in Wisconsin, I just wanted to mention this, I was tailing the suspected mistress of a national religious leader. And it was about this cold, and I ended up spending the night in my car. So this is actually a big improvement for me. So,
she didn't, though. She didn't, though, did
she? No. No. But we're not here to talk about ice, but rather about water, specifically the Clean Water Act. My name's Craig Pittman. I'm a reporter for the St. Petersburg Times, Florida's largest newspaper, or as we like to call it, Florida's least shrinking newspaper. And I'm also the co-author of a book on the Clean Water Act called Paving Paradise. Please buy lots of copies. Thank you. We're very fortunate to have a rather diverse and very, very well-educated panel today to talk about the Clean Water Act and why it's still violated after all these years. I'm going to give you a little more background about them as we go on, but just briefly I wanted to introduce them. Please welcome Jeremy Korsnack of the United States Department of Justice, Dr. Joy Ziedler of the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and Michael Caine, no, not that Michael Caine, longtime attorney for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We had hoped to get Charles Duhigg of the New York Times here, but he called me Thursday and had to back out, unfortunately. So before we go on, I thought it would be helpful to give you a little bit of background on the Clean Water Act itself and how it was passed and why it's probably the most optimistic law that Congress ever passed. Like a second.
We're all PowerPoint addicts. How are you doing?
Oh, you knew it? Oh, awesome. You guys think of everything. Okay. It originated, like most U.S. environmental legislation, in the 1970s, the same era that brought us Earth Day, the EPA, and Free Bird Man, yeah.
You think that out of the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, you might want to put that in your lap so people can see past it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We're dealing with delicate machinery. next one. So after decades of dumping, the nation's waterways were just basically filthy sewers, and people were starting to notice the consequences of that, the most famous, of course, being the Cuyahoga River, which caught fire, thus giving Randy Newman a good topic for a song. Our waterways were plagued by fish kills. I'm proud to say that the largest was in Florida, my very own Florida, Lake Thanatassassa, 26 million dead fish littering the surface of the water. The Detroit River had six times the healthy limit for mercury in it, and two-thirds of the country's lakes, rivers, and coastal waters were declared unsafe for fishing or for swimming. Clearly, something needed to be done. And so up stepped the U.S. Senate, and particularly the Senate's Mr. Clean, Senator Ed Muskie of Maine, who had sponsored the Clean Water Act. He was at the time, by the way, considered the front-runner for the Democratic nomination for president in 1972. Muskie introduced a bill, then known as the Amendments to the Federal Water Pollution Control Act of 1948. You can see why I shortened the name. He managed to get bipartisan support for this bill, particularly from Senator Howard Baker of Tennessee. The House passed a weaker version, and over a long, long, long process of conference committees during which Muskie's presidential campaign came unraveled, they managed to work things out. But then they ran into...
Bump, bump, bump.
Richard Nixon. He had a problem with the bill. His own EPA administrator, Russell Train, was urging him to sign it, saying, this is great, we need this. But Nixon had a problem with the cost. What he was concerned about was that the bill proposed spending... can't read my own notes. Spending billions of dollars to help clean up sewer plants around the country, and that was, $24 billion, and that was $18 billion more than he wanted to spend. Don't be too hard on Tricky Dick. He was busy dealing with Watergate at the time, too. He's a little distracted. So he vetoed the bill, but Congress voted to override it. It was the first time they had overridden any of Nixon's vetoes during his term in office. And a big reason was, once again, the bipartisan support. Howard Baker, in a speech, said, "If we cannot swim in our lakes and rivers, if we cannot breathe the air God has given us, what other comforts can life offer us?" And so just hours after Nixon's veto, they overrode the veto. It was 52-12 in the Senate, 247-23 in the House. Now let's talk about how incredibly optimistic this law was. Its objectives, go ahead, all waters would be fishable and swimmable by 1983. And that was just the interim goal. The ultimate goal, eliminate all pollution discharges to the nation's waterways by 1985. I think we missed the deadline. One part of the bill was Section 404. That proposed to put what one of the congressional aides called a reasonable curb on filling in wetlands, because they could see the impact that was having on the nation's waterways, too, the loss of wetlands. And the EPA was in charge of permitting for everything except for 404. 404 fell to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, not a traditionally known as a champion of the environment. But that's the nature of compromise. But now let's talk about what's happened since then. Obviously, not only did we miss the deadlines, but it's still violated after all these years. Are we having problems with?
No,
it's working up there. Okay, go ahead. Okay, there have been repeated water quality problems all around the country, and that pollution is leading to human health problems. Mr. Duhigg, who was supposed to be here, just recently did a story that started with profiling this family. This young man, the damage done to his teeth was done by the water coming out of his tap. It was eating the enamel off of his teeth. When it comes to the 404 permitting process for wetlands, the Corps of Engineers never says no. It's a most permissive permitting program. And when the government does become active and does try to enforce it, faces strong criticism. Most recently, a good example is in West Virginia, where the EPA has put the brakes on the issuance of mountaintop mining permits for the mining industry there because of concerns about the impact of pollution. And the governor and mining industry people have been referring to this as state-sponsored terrorism. On behalf of the EPA. So that leads us very naturally into our first panelist. When you see a story in the paper about a big Clean Water Act enforcement case, chances are the prosecution was led by our first speaker, Jeremy Korsnick. For instance, in 2003, a case that he pursued against Tyson Foods led to the company pleading guilty to 20 violations of the Clean Water Act and agreeing to pay fines totaling more than $7 million. Please welcome Jeremy Korsnick.
Thank you. I just want to pause for a technical break here, so I'm going to switch computers and lose all the momentum of my great introduction.
Well, while he's doing that, I just want to mention there's lots more Clean Water Act background in my book, and at our website we've got a blog devoted to Clean Water Act issues if you're interested. And now we'll do impressions to fill time. Sure. The no net loss is a federal policy that is tied to 404. It's not part of the law. It's just a federal policy. Sort of like the Pirates Code in Pirates of the Caribbean. It's more of a guideline. It's going to be worth the wait, I promise.
I thought you had a different adapter.
Hey, holy cow, it worked. I mean, of course it worked.
down at the bottom. There's a, where's the show?
Go, yeah. That's it. Yeah.
Okay. All right, first, by way of background, I'm going to stand. It's one of the... All right.
Yeah, please take that.
Okay. Try.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
They're recording the session.
Okay. Just by way of background, I've been with the Department of Justice's Environmental Crimes Section for 18 years. And before that was with the State Attorney General's Office in New Hampshire for 7.5, starting with homicides and then getting into environmental and bringing the first environmental criminal cases there. Just so you understand in terms of structure, what we've been talking here about the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act has both civil and criminal provisions. Pretty much any violation of the Clean Water Act that can be brought civilly can also be brought as a criminal case. And what I want to do today is talk about the three main provisions or the kinds of three main kinds of cases that we bring at the Department of Justice in coordination, of course, with the state folks. And that is, a point of starting here in terms of structure. That, and many of you have dealt with these issues, so I don't want to repeat what you already know. But you understand that there is overlapping enforcement authority for the Clean Water Act. The federal government passed, as Craig described, the Clean Water Act. That required states to pass parallel laws and allocated the responsibility to the states for the enforcement, primary enforcement and oversight, and in particular, the derivation of and the creation and enforcement of Clean Water Act permits. There is overlapping authority there as well. As Craig mentioned, the 404 permits, wetlands permits are issued by the Corps of Engineers, but most direct discharge permits that factories or publicly owned sewer treatment works get are issued by state authorities. Okay. Before I go much further, I should tell you I got an email from the Department of Justice headquarters last night concerned that I was speaking to journalists. So,
as well they should.
They should be concerned. And I want to say on a personal note that I'm always happy to talk to journalists. There is a certain kind of commonality between us. I mean, we sort of do the same things. When I say we, I mean prosecutors and journalists. We basically investigate. Sort of 90% of what I do. You talk to people, get documents. Of course, we have things called grand jury subpoenas, and we
Can
talk
we
to
have
people.
One of those?
We also have thumb screws and other means of pressure and compulsion and threats of jail. But that's essentially what we do. We talk to people, we investigate things, we try to find out what happened, and then we try to tell the story. We write it up, and we talk to juries and explain and find the right hook and explain how this whole mass of documents, photographs, interview reports adds up to a story, and a story with a conclusion, of course, that we're specifically asking for. But we do sort of the same thing, but apropos of the email I got from the Department of Justice, I'm required to tell you that all opinions expressed here are my own and not that of the Department of Justice, so that if you are cavalier, foolish enough to quote me, you're on your own. It does raise a question, I must say, in my own mind as to what I've been doing for the last 18 years and whether the convictions that I've gotten, the press conferences I've done and the closing statements and witness interviews I've done in court were in my own personal capacity or official capacity, but when I get back to Washington, I'll find out. Let me describe just briefly the criminal provisions of the Clean Water Act, And just by way of introduction to that, as I said before, pretty much the same violations have been brought civilly or criminally. So the distinction, and this is a topic for an entire separate discussion, as to what kinds of violations merit criminal prosecution. If really the line between a civil case and a criminal case is in the prosecutor's mind, what goes on in a prosecutor's mind to determine if somebody should just, you know, get a civil petition for an injunction and perhaps a penalty, or be subject to incarceration? And maybe in some of the cases I illustrate, you'll see what the lines are. But it certainly is something that we talk about a lot at the environmental crime section, and we often disagree about. One of the things that is different in the criminal area, as opposed to the civil, is that we have a 5-year statute of limitations, so we can't prosecute anybody for any conduct that occurred prior more than 5 years ago. Let me talk about the three kinds of violations we tend to do. It is a 3-year felony to discharge a pollutant into a water of the United States without a permit or in violation of a permit. All right. I want to illustrate that with a case. Second, as Craig mentioned, it's a 3-year felony to discharge a pollutant, to fill, that would be a fill, place fill, into a wetland that is a water of the United States. It is a 3-year felony as well to interfere with the proper operation of a sewage treatment plant. And this is a little complicated because sewage treatment plants have their own NPDES, National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permit, Clean Water Act permit. But because there's a recognition that there are many sources of pollutants that go into wastewater treatment plants, that wastewater treatment plants have to handle and treat down to permit discharge levels, there are restrictions as to what you can place into it, and if people dump the wrong stuff in that can interfere with the operation of the permit, we federal authorities and state authorities can bring separate actions against those people discharging into the POTW. Okay. Best thing for me to do right now is to let me say there's also another little add-on that's sort of often a criminal provision that we use with respect to the first category of cases, the violation of a permit or without a permit, and that is self-reporting is required for permit compliance. And if you falsify a discharge monitoring report that you're required to submit on a monthly basis or whatever the basis may be, that in itself is a separate felony. If you tamper with monitoring equipment, that also would be a 3-year felony. Let me illustrate the first category of cases, that being a discharge in violation of a permit or without a permit, and talk about for a moment the Central Industries case. So let's try the first slide. Okay. Craig mentioned the Tyson case. The Tyson case was a case brought against Tyson Foods, the largest meat packer in the world, and involving a plant in Missouri. This was a set of cases or a case that I did in Mississippi involving the largest agricultural industry, I understand, in the state, and that is the poultry industry. This is a plant, Central Industries, that was a rendering plant, which is really what they call a protein conversion plant. It's a recycling plant. They take guts and feathers and heads and feet of chickens and do all kinds of interesting stuff with it. They turn it to dog food. They take the fats and they put them in big centrifuges and spin them out and use them for all kinds of things, including one of the primary uses is the basis for women's cosmetics. So, this is a big rendering plant that was owned by 5 different producers, slaughterhouses. That's their big wastewater lagoon, and you can see off to the left the discharge stream into which it went. And I want to talk about that later in the last part of the talk about the jurisdictional issues we're going to have. The plant had been in violation of its permit for about 20 years intermittently. They would essentially keep ramping up production way beyond the capacity of the wastewater treatment plant's ability to handle and treat down the waste to permit levels. Let me illustrate. The next slide. That's one of the lagoons. Next. And you understand, this is, and I was there. This is in the middle of the summer, the sweltering heat of Mississippi. You can smell this literally miles away. Next. That is the discharge point. Next. This tributary, this is a tributary to the Pearl River, which is the drinking water supply for the city of Jackson. Okay. That is just a picture of the violations here. So we're not talking about just close calls. This is way, way over the... This is literally, literally off the charts. And you can see it goes way back, and I didn't put them on. This was going to be a trial exhibit. Next. Fecal coliform, one of the parameters. Next.
Where's the legitimate level on these?
You see, I'm sorry, way down the bottom where the arrow is?
Yeah.
You barely see it. Okay, next. You can see that's the there are two lines. One is for the daily maximum. The other is for any grab sample maximum. So, but wait a minute. Okay. All right, next. Just pictures of pollution, that's all.
You use the caption in the trial?
I didn't, no. all right, what happened?
That's the opinion.
We filed, it was a fairly aggressive action, and we don't have time for a lecture about conspiracy charging, but I charged the conspiracy here in large measure because it allowed me to bring in evidence past the 5-year statute of limitations, demonstrating all the violations they'd committed and all the notices of violation they'd gotten for the last 20, 25 years. I brought actions that was fairly aggressive against the company itself, Central Industries, but also all the companies that owned that company. And if you can imagine the temerity, some of the CEOs of those companies who were absolutely shocked and appalled that we would do such a thing. And it raised issues of responsible corporate officer doctrine liability under the Clean Water Act, which I did push here. It resolved. It was a really interesting case, and we don't have time to go into it in great detail, except this is an illustration. Okay, this is clearly a permit violation, Clean Water Act, long history of violations, which certainly was part of the motivation for making it a criminal case, and the assignment of individual responsibility on the not just because they were presidents of the companies, but because I could show, and I can't describe it in any detail right now, that they knew or should have known that their production levels were going way, way up and their spending on wastewater treatment was just petering along on a level. All right, next. Tell me, what do I got? Okay, let's move quickly. I got 3 minutes. I got to go. They filed $14 million penalty and an apology. Next. This is the Mississippi mud caper. This is a wetlands case that I did in Mississippi. Next slide. I'll show you the next slide. Next. These are overlays that we did on a map. This site is about 8 miles Mississippi Gulf Coast and involved the development of about... keep going. Yep. I want to get the overall map. All right, there we go. This involved the development of about 2,600 acres, half of which is wetland, subdivided into small lots that were sold to individuals, about 400 lots. It's a very long and interesting story. The gist of it was that these lots could not be developed under state law because they were wetland lots, and the sewage treatment systems that they were putting in, just septic tanks, can't work in wetlands because there's no aeration. So there were lots of stories here about people who bought homes, and this is the journalism side of it, who bought homes that sank into the mud. where sewage systems failed and sewage was backing up into homes and in backyards. Lots of stories. And it presented itself to me very well as a wetlands case because I didn't just charge Clean Water Act counts here, 404. But there was this, in most wetlands cases, the only thing you can argue is how it's an attenuated harm, the value of wetlands, flood control, swamp critters. Here, what did I have? I had victims. I had people who could get on the stand and say, he told me it was high and dry. He said that this permit, that this septic system was fully permitted, and, well, it was, but by an engineer who he was paying off, essentially. So there were all kinds of interesting public corruption stuff that I really don't have, but it was a fascinating story. But you can see how I had to tell a story, too. And my story was about how this wetlands development not only resulted in the destruction of wetlands after numerous warnings from the Corps of Engineers in the state, but how there were victims here, and the victims were on the stand to tell you what happened to them. Okay, 404, next. Unfortunately, I don't... This is the jurisdictional challenge. I'm going to just take a minute to talk about this. This is very important. Part of the challenge of this case occurred after what was called the Swank case. And it was a case in which the federal government was told it didn't have authority over isolated wetlands. Okay, and the issue as to what an isolated wetlands was somewhat uncertain. It was an evolving law in the Fifth Circuit where I was. Next slide, there's some overlays on that. It had to bear some significant relationship, the court said, to navigable, in fact, waters. The Clean Water Act, they said, doesn't give you, the federal government, authority to regulate a mud puddle in the middle of the country or a wetland in the middle of the country. It's the clean water. You have to show some federal jurisdiction. And in the Swank case, they said the fact that migratory birds fly over it and use it as a nesting area or a feeding area on the way north or south, that's not adequate for you, the federal government, to have authority over it. So go ahead, next. So we had, all right, that's fine. Just back up. Okay, so the question in that case was, is it an isolated wetlands, or is there a sufficient connection with navigable waters of the United States that I, the federal government, have authority to regulate and I'll bring criminal charges? So the defense was always arguing, sure, they're wetlands, but they're not wetlands that Jeremy can do anything about. Okay, next slide. So what did I do? In order to prove jurisdiction, I had to show the relationship between the wetlands that I alleged had been illegally filled and waters of the United States. And this is a story unto itself, but there was an awful lot of work we did to show jurisdiction. Next slide. Next slide. So I had agents going down boating areas, showing how the wetlands that I had charged were part of a whole a watershed that led finally to, keep going, navigable waters of the United States. There's my friend Casey Campbell doing that, and how it connected with the Lotson issue. Next. Okay, used aerial photographs. That's the site or part of the site in an aerial in 1980. Look, there's no development at all. Next. Some development. There we go. And I could show, there's the wetlands. I could show after each warning there's more development. Go ahead. Look, more and more, 03. And those are the portions that were developed. Next. Okay, that's the whole lot. Let's look at all the red area that was developed in wetlands after the developers were told can't do that. Next.
Where was this?
This was in Southern Mississippi trial. It was two months long trial in Gulfport, Mississippi. Those are the sentences, pretty harsh. 108 months, 87 months, and 87 months. And they're in jail now. But mainly, part of the harsh sentence came out of the fraud convictions as well. Next slide. I can't talk about POTWs. I don't know why this. Maybe you should. Okay. All right. Well, that's great. All right. While we're talking about that, I'm going to talk very quickly about POTW cases. I'm about to indict one in a southern state involving. I didn't do that. It's in the software, I guess, where they throw in no extra charge. POTW cases, people who are discharging, in this case, huge amounts of grease, people who were in the business of removing grease from restaurant traps. who are obligated to dispose of it properly and safely. We're dumping it into the sewer system and causing the sewer system to basically not function. So that it wasn't really, who would think restaurant grease is dangerous? It's not. I mean, it's cooking oil. So it's not hazardous waste that you think is the, basically the purview of somebody like me. But it's just cooking grease. But what it does is it results in the discharge of millions of gallons of untreated or undertreated sewage and causes the sewage treatment plant to violate its permits. So that's our authority over it. In this particular sewage system, there were all kinds of notices as to how the sewage system wasn't working right. EPA told them to clean up their act. They did. They implemented this whole grease control program. And this company went into these big restaurants and said, on the pretext, and basically promised to dispose of their waste properly, filed false manifests making it look like it was disposing the stuff properly, but essentially just went after they filled up their 4,000-gallon tanker trucks, would go to the next customer and shoot 4,000 gallons through the grease trap of the next customer, pull out the next load. It saved them the money of having to dispose of it legally, and it saved them the cost of and time of shipping it to the proper disposal area. So there they were doing exactly what they were paid to prevent from happening and causing the harm, the occlusions of the systems, the treatment problems that they were there to prevent. So I think it's a good criminal case, and we'll see if the jury thinks so. Okay, all right. I don't have time to talk about this case. This was the McQueen case. And I should mention this, and this is important in terms of a common interest between journalists and prosecutors. This case, and this was a big pipe manufacturing facility in Birmingham. This case and three others like it were initiated by the Department of Justice because one of your colleagues, a couple of them, David Barstow of the New York Times, began an investigation of this company. And there is a symbiosis between us, and it's an important one. He got a Pulitzer for that. We filed four separate cases against this company as a result of his set of stories. We started a worker endangerment initiative that led to the conviction of this company in four different districts and other cases as well. There was another case that I did some years ago involving the ship scrapping industry, interesting set of stories done by Will Englund from the Baltimore Sun. He won a Pulitzer for that series as well. Also, another important confluence of interest is this, that we provide often the content of some of your stories. And what you do for us is, I think, at least twofold anyway. But one is educate the general public about these issues, which makes legislation possible, which creates the political context in which legislation occurs. And also, and I always say this to my colleagues, that if nobody knows about our convictions, there's no deterrent effect. Deterrence is only a function of an informed public. So I want to thank you for that. There is an important issue that I want to talk about. Maybe we can discussion. And the question is, what is the scope of the Clean Water Act after this case, after the McQueen case? But it's something that maybe we can raise later on. Thank you very much for your time.
Our next speaker is Dr. Joy Ziedler, the Aldo Leopold Professor of Restoration Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Because of her vast expertise in dealing with wetlands, she was selected to chair a National Research Council panel that in 2001 produced this, a blistering report on the government's failures to make up for wetland losses under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. How blistering? Before I read this, I had hair. Okay. So please welcome Dr. Joy Ziedler.
Thank you very much. I always like that. It's always chancy to shut down. I see.
Yeah. You want to cancel? Yeah.
What I'm going to talk about is why we should never have to get to the litigation that Jeremy just told you about. If everybody did their job well and listened to the scientists, we wouldn't have to go to that level of prosecution. So, let's see. Right here.
May I just borrow this?
Yes. Yeah.
Take that. I can speak from over here, I guess. Sorry. How did I get to there? My screen isn't working. That's the whole problem. I didn't expect to be in charge of logistics today. I'm trying to get to this. I know. If I move it up, I'll get it. And then I'm not left-handed either. There we go. Right. There. Okay. So, why should damages to wetlands be mitigated? That's the question I'll try to answer today. And it's because ecosystems provide for us ecosystem services, things that we all need and value. And the problem is that we have this legislation that says if you do discharge or you do damage significantly wetlands or waters of the United States, that process should be mitigated before you get a permit. Now, the problem is that mitigation doesn't mean prevention, and it does not mean that no net loss of ecosystem or wetland area or function will be the law of the land. We have a policy that says there shall be no net loss. We don't have the legislation that prevents it. Projects that are requiring a permit under the Section 404 of the Clean Water Act must undergo a sequence. First, you attempt to avoid the damage. Obviously not what was done in the previous presentation. If you can't avoid it, then minimize the impacts to a level called insignificance, whatever that means. And lastly, if you can't minimize, then you can get a permit, but you must compensate for the damages. So the aim of mitigation is really to sustain area and function of wetlands. And it's those. The area is easy to track. That you saw that in the maps. But what about function? If you think about that, it's far more difficult than overlaying homes on top of a wetland, because you can have a significant impact on a wetland without building the home right on top of it. Well, I'm going to just flash through four slides. The main functions we worry about as scientists are biodiversity, and there are reasons why wetlands do these functions well relative to uplands and that justify the Clean Water Act, but I won't go into those in detail. So biodiversity support, water quality improvement, flood abatement, and carbon storage are things that wetlands really do well. And here is the this would be a stunning, I think, point to make to the general public, that using some rather crude data from Robert Costanza in 1997, we can calculate just how much area of wetland there is on the globe, and that's about 1.5% of all of the globe. But what percentage of those ecosystem services are wetlands responsible for? And depending on how you calculate it, I came up with as much as 40%. Even if I'm off by a factor of two, wetlands provide more functions than their area would predict. They are hyperfunctional. And Wisconsin, just by the way, has lost only 46% of its wetland area, whereas the nation as a whole on average has lost, that is, the 48 states that are contiguous, have lost 53%. So we're not so bad as some of our friends. Now, when you lose those wetlands or you damage them and you need to mitigate those impacts, historically, many of the project proponents have mitigated by creating ponds. And they are great favorites for mitigation because a pond clearly satisfies the replacement of a wetland. At least a pond is a wetland. It's got wetland hydrology, wetland soil, and wetland vegetation. But ponds do not necessarily replace those water quality improvement, biodiversity functions, flood abatement functions, or carbon storage functions that are being lost in the project that generated mitigation. In this country, we have hundreds of types of wetlands, and those are classified by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And their ecosystem services differ. Swamps probably store a lot more carbon than do sedge meadows, and sedge meadows may well support a lot more diversity than swamps. The problem is that nationwide we don't have the inventory of functions, so I can't tell you exactly what every wetland does, and therefore it makes it hard to ask somebody to lessen the damages to those functions. It takes a lot of ecological study to quantify functioning. Much easier just to work with acreage. So in this book that Craig mentioned, a collection of about a dozen scientists, wetland scientists from around the nation, came together in Washington, D.C. for the National Research Council, which is the working arm of the National Academy, and developed a number of, I guess, scenarios like we saw with Jeremy's presentation of the problems with mitigation, and then came up with a bunch of recommendations. And the rosy view is in pink, and the cautionary notes are in yellow. So we called for the Corps to improve its regulatory guidelines, and especially to do this mitigation work not willy-nilly here and there, but within a watershed framework. And the Corps and the EPA adopted our recommendations, but that took about 6-7 years. And these new regulatory guidelines still do not prevent loss. And here's why. We found that some permittees did not even attempt to do the mitigation work. Some tried but did not meet the performance standards in the mitigation agreement. And some met those compliance requirements but still didn't provide the necessary or desired ecological functions. And very few of those permittees actually set up long-term procedures to maintain what they had created or restored. We concluded that in our review that there were some advantages to having mitigation banks or in-lieu fee projects that could allow mitigation to operate better than having an individual permittee do things right on site in kind. And we also concluded that we should have some interagency review and long-term stewardship. That's a very rosy view. And the Corps agreed, but they required the staff to examine in order, first the mitigation bank, which is always off-site and often out of kind, then to look at in-lieu fee programs where you just charge the guys a fee and figure out, I should say guys or gals, and then figure out what to do with that money, and that there should be a watershed approach, but if there isn't a watershed plan, you don't need to do the watershed approach. So those are the buts behind each of those things. Mitigation banks, where are they? Are they in the right places? In-lieu fees, what are the opportunities? Are they priorities? And what do you do when there really isn't a watershed plan? Which former wetlands really should be restored first, and in which places to regain those services? So we are operating in a black box. Here's the rosy view. We said there should be a water approach, and the new regulatory guidelines call for that watershed approach. It says use a watershed approach in selecting compensatory mitigation project locations. Set up ecological performance standards, regular monitoring, complete compensatory mitigation plans. That's the rosy view. But the effectiveness depends on implementation, as is always the case, and there is neither a firm requirement nor guidance for developing restoration plans or construction of wetlands to mitigate damages at the watershed scale. It's just, I guess, too difficult. It's nobody's job to come up with a watershed plan. Here's what I think you can help with. Environmental journalists can call for these watershed plans. It's got to be somebody's job to make sure that we have plans to do the restoration and wetland construction work within watersheds. It's got to be somebody's job. Which wetlands should be restored first, where and why, and if there's nothing left to restore, where should we build new ones? I think environmental journalists can identify regulatory districts that do not follow that required sequence. Call attention to where the impacts are not being avoided, and thank you, Jeremy, for your work in this area, where impacts should be minimized and are not being minimized, and making sure that they're compensated when there are significant impacts, and highlight projects that take place in places like fens and bogs and sedge meadows that are really hard to replace. They really can't be replaced. And thirdly, environmental journalists should call for those watershed plans, and it can take this relatively simple approach of first figuring out what's the condition of the current and the former wetlands in a watershed. What do we have that's left? Secondly, where are these remnants that are left that should be conserved and protected? Which of the former wetlands are most restorable? And what services are restorable? And then we can put those sites and priorities on maps. Okay. And I can stop there, or I can give an example here of a stellar example of a watershed plan just south of Sydney in New South Wales. And it just indicates that this is doable. There's a whole book on this process by Brierley and Friars, and they came up with a simple process by just assessing the condition of reaches of streams and then assessing the restoration potential and coming up with the optimal place to start is where you have the systems that aren't in such bad shape that are easily restorable. Work on those first. It's a simple process, but it's nobody's job to come up with that watershed plan. So I would really love to discuss further with journalists exactly what you can do to help in this arena and prevent us from getting to the point where we have to litigate the unpermitted projects. Thank you.
Our final panelist has been working on Clean Water Act issues longer than anybody else in this room. Attorney Michael Caine joined the staff of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources in 1976 and served as lead attorney for the Surface Water, Dam Safety, and Wetland Program from 1978 until his retirement last year. He won the DNR's Brogan Award for Outstanding Environmental Achievement in 1995. And I should mention, by the way, that although he says he didn't do this, but Wisconsin was the first state to actually achieve those fishable, swimmable standards in 1983, right on time under what the Clean Water Act called for. Please welcome Michael Caine.
Thank you, Craig.
I can push it. And I want to talk a little bit this morning about the Wisconsin approach. We have taken a bit of a different approach than some of the other states because we recognize that a lot of the things that were happening nationally were problematic. What Jeremy talked about with some of the prosecutions in the southern states, we don't see those sorts of problems with wetland cases in Wisconsin. If you read Craig's book, they are still issuing permits in Florida where they are permitting 600 to 1,000 acres of fill in one fell swoop. I know somebody from the National Wildlife Federation who was prosecuting two cases or appealing two cases last year where 600 acres of fill were placed. In Wisconsin, we're fighting over tenths of an acre of wetlands, and we don't see these, and I want to tell the story about how we got there. And I also want to talk a little bit about the Swank case that Jeremy talked about and Wisconsin's approach to that and our support for the Clean Water Restoration Act, which Senator Feingold has introduced, and Representative Oberstar from Minnesota, and is currently pending. There's going to be a hearing, in fact, this next week in the House on that issue. Little history. We've lost about 50% of our pre-settlement wetlands, but we have 15,000 lakes, 44,000 miles of rivers, and 860 miles of Great Lakes shoreline in Wisconsin. Wetlands are important here, both from an ecological perspective and economically. The understanding of the value of wetlands has increased over time, and our regulations in Wisconsin have evolved along with that. This is the percentage of wetlands lost nationally. If you look at the Mississippi River Basin, a lot of the states have lost 80 to 90% of their wetlands. And I don't know if you've read about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Even the Supreme Court recognized that this is a cause for what's happened down there. In Wisconsin, we have a public trust under our Constitution, Article 9, Section 1, that says all waters are held in trust for the people. We have a land and water ethic that, from my perspective, has developed. I was happy to see that they're handing out Sand County Almanac. For those of you who haven't read it, it's a good read. And I think that helped build some of the water and land ethic in Wisconsin. We have many common law cases, which I was involved in litigating some of the more recent ones, and our statutes and regulations sort of incorporate this. One early case, 1966, Hickson versus PSC. This is about a 1,000-acre lake in Vilas County. An individual up there dredged and filled an area and put a fill out into the water. He basically built this solid pier. And the state went after him and said it had to come out. And he said, this is just a small intrusion into a 1,000-acre lake. You know, why is this important? And in 1966, our Supreme Court said, a little fill here and there may seem to be nothing to become excited about. Before long, a great body of water may be eaten away until it may no longer exist. This is what he was allowed to keep. Our navigable waters are a precious natural heritage. Once gone, they disappear forever. So this is one of the cornerstones of our laws in Wisconsin. Another seminal case, Just versus Marinette. This dealt with shoreland and wetland zoning in 1972. The Just wanted to put a building pad in a wetland. Marinette County said, you can't. They said, this is a taking of our land. Went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court in 1972 said swamps and wetlands were once considered wasteland. Now we recognize that they play a vital role in nature. And the Supreme Court here asked this question, is the ownership of a parcel of land so absolute that man can change its nature to suit any of his purposes? And in 1972, they answered that question to say, an owner of land has no absolute right to change the essential natural character of his land so as to use it for a purpose for which it was unsuited in its natural state. It's not an unreasonable exercise of the police power to prevent harm, and they said it wasn't a takings. And so this really is the foundation. And as I go around the country and talk about our program, our wetland program, which really is sort of a model program, other people are astonished, you know, that we have these as foundations. But I think they're important. One of the things that I'd like to do in my retirement is try to export some of these ideas. And you, as environmental journalists, I hope can help export some of these ideas to your home states if these things are not being considered there now. We became concerned in the early 1980s because the Corps of Engineers was issuing nationwide permits where they were authorizing originally 10 acres, then 5 acres, and then 2 acres. There was, you know, if we were below that threshold, there was no federal permit required, or that we were easily granted. And we started denying certification under Section 401 of the Clean Water Act. No federal permit can be issued unless the state says it's consistent with our state standards. And so the Corps was upset about that, but we were successful in getting these modified, and we had special conditions in Wisconsin. But then we realized that we were still losing too many wetlands, and so we decided we had to adopt our own Wisconsin wetland water quality standards, which we did in late 1980s, early 1990s. And in 1991, we adopted the first set of wetland water quality standards for wetlands that any state had adopted in the nation. They were modeled after the EPA guidelines. We had the sequencing process that was described. It applied to all wetlands in the state. We used narrative standards, natural scenic beauty, water quality, habitat, because you couldn't use the 2 parts per million, 5 parts per million for open water bodies. We rigorously apply the sequencing process in Wisconsin. Avoid first. If you can avoid, we don't get to the mitigation question. And when we adopted these rules, we didn't consider mitigation at all, because we felt that the federal agencies were turning the process on its head and going right to mitigation. Went the wrong way here. Let's see if I can get back. And so what was the effect? We were losing about 1,400 acres a year in Wisconsin before we adopted our rules. In 2006, we were down to 55 acres of permitted fills in the state of Wisconsin, 600 permits. We also lose about 150 acres a year for DOT projects in Wisconsin. When you compare this to what's going on in a lot of the southern states, I think that we're very proud of what we've accomplished. It works well. The thoughtful analysis of alternatives that we require really changes the scope of projects. When I first started, before we had our rules, we would see people coming in with proposals for golf courses and subdivisions where they propose 10 or 20 or 30 acres of wetland fill. Now, if we see somebody coming in with an acre or two of wetland fill, we know that they're probably from out of state because we generally don't authorize those. And consultants and attorneys, we've done a lot of training, and we're seeing much better projects coming in the door. The Swank decision in 2001, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in January of 2001 that isolated wetlands were not covered anymore. We knew that that decision might be coming down. We estimated there was going to be about 1 million acres of wetlands that were isolated, would no longer be protected under the Clean Water Act in Wisconsin by the feds. We went to the legislature and to the governor. We helped draft a piece of legislation. The Wisconsin Senate quickly adopted it. The Assembly adopted an alternative. We had 5 months of negotiations, and the governor called a special session just to adopt this wetland bill. He was a Republican governor at the time, Scott McCallum, and this was adopted unanimously in both houses of our Wisconsin legislature. The Builders and the Sierra Club put their both of their names on a letter and sent it to every legislator and said, this is a good bill, and it should be adopted to protect our wetlands. We intended to restore the water quality certification coverage for all Wisconsin wetlands. We retained the Clean Water Act exemptions for farming and silviculture. Personally, I'd like to see some of those eroded, but we had to agree to do that. And we lost about 43 acres of wetlands. Fortunately, the decision came down in January. It's cold and icy here, so not many people could do development, but we kept track of what we were losing. Anything that's determined to be a non-federal wetland by a federal agency then has to go into a state certification, and we take that over and we go through the process here. The Rapanos case, there's some 2006 cases. The Supreme Court had two cases, Caribou and Rapanos. We defined non-federal wetland as anything that was affected by SWANC or any subsequent interpretations by federal agencies or federal appellate courts, and so we have the Rapanos and Caribou wetlands also covered by this. Senator Feingold has put together a bill to clarify the Clean Water Act and to basically clean up what the Supreme Court has done. It was first introduced in 2003, didn't go anywhere, has been reintroduced consistently. There have been The Senate Public Works Committee has adopted a version, and there's going to be a hearing this week that Oberstar is having, and hopefully there'll be a conference committee, and there's some hope that a bill will be passed this year. I've had calls from some people in Washington saying, well, you guys don't care, do you? You've got your own program up there. Why do you care? We care a lot because it still impacts water quality in our state. It impacts the flyways, the Mississippi Flyway and the Prairie Potholes. If those are filled in, we don't get the birds and the other things that people like to watch and hunt here in Wisconsin. And so we are concerned about those potential losses. We're also very active, the staff at the Department of Natural Resources. There's a badger poll that the University of Wisconsin does every year. We put some wetland questions on that. And 84% of the people in Wisconsin said they were concerned about the potential loss of Wisconsin's remaining wetlands. 86% said that they supported tax incentives to preserve wetlands. There are a number of pieces of legislation going through the Wisconsin legislature now to deal with some of these issues. Obviously, don't have time to talk about them this morning. We have on the department's web pages a lot of information on wetlands. If you go to, and for some reason it got covered, dnr.wisconsin.gov wetlands, or just Google Wisconsin DNR and wetlands, you can get to all of that information. And so I'll end with an Aldo Leopold quote that I use in all of my presentations. But, you know, in Wisconsin, we've tried to go a different direction. We collaborate closely with the Corps of Engineers and other federal agencies, and the Corps, especially out of the St. Paul District, does a very effective job, but there are limits coming out of Washington on what sort of things that they can do. But for those of you, how many here are from Wisconsin? Okay, so a lot of people from out of state. I guess we'd like to tell this story, and I think that other states can do a lot of the things that we have done. Our legislation and our rules are out there, and the Association of State Wetland Managers puts them out there as sort of models to use. So thank you for your attention.
Holy cow, we've actually got time for questions. Isn't that great? I'm told to tell you that SEJ members get to ask first. So do we have any SEJ members that would like to ask questions? Yes, ma'am, right in the front.
Hi.
Flashing the badge is a good idea. I like that.
Jeremy. The DOJ guy.
Yeah.
My question is kind of like a three-part, very quick question. Now I think you can answer them all pretty quickly. What agencies? So after an actual violation of litigation has taken place, what agencies are involved in oversight to make sure that the plant is staying in compliance after all the litigation? How frequently are they monitoring it, and how effectively are they monitoring it? So if a plant is found in violation, who makes sure that afterwards they clean up their act and that it follows through with them years after?
If they're convicted?
If they're convicted.
Okay. Quick answer, a number of options. My own personal preference is to leave it up to the state regulators who are generally in control of Clean Water Act permits anyway. One would hope that a criminal conviction would be a significant deterrent. There are some of us, there are, like with the Tyson case, the company agreed to third-party monitoring. To have somebody come in and to do an environmental assessment. Everybody has their own views of the efficacy of that. I think that's generally more useful in a smaller operation. A company like Tyson is sophisticated. It doesn't need to pay a consultant to tell it what it needs to do. So that the there's another issue. I'm not going to go into it, but generally, these are set as conditions of probation in a criminal case. So you're having the people who are probably least able to monitor those things, the U.S. Probation Service, who are comfortable with checking out urine tests to make sure nobody's taking drugs. And are those really the people who should be monitoring sophisticated and compliance programs? Of course, when it's done in conjunction with a state person. My own feeling is that we do compliance monitoring as part of criminal pleas and as part of convictions. My own view is that our job on the criminal side, my personal view, on the criminal side is to create a deterrent. You now understand that those are the rules and you got to follow them. If you do it again, we'll prosecute you again. We're not going to hold your hand and show you how to do it right.
Do you have a lot of repeat offenders?
No. I should say, in the Lucas case I described, oddly enough, Mr. Lucas, while he was on, he had been sentenced to 108 months in jail, and while he was out, because of the Rapanos case, they appealed the conviction, saying federal government got it all wrong, and those wetlands are, they might have been jurisdictional under Swank, but not under Rapanos. So even while he was out, the judge said, you can stay out of jail while it's on appeal. Even while he was out of jail, awaiting the appellate decision, he continued to develop other areas, other properties he owned, fill in parts of the Pascagoula River, which was designated as wild and scenic river, and to sell again some of the same lots he'd been convicted of having sold. So I did seek a motion for probation. He was thrown in jail. Sorry.
Hey, a man's got to pay his lawyer. Yes, sir.
Mark Schlesing of the Times Picayune in New Orleans. And I guess this is for Jeremy, and I'd love to hear what Michael has to say about it. In the state of Louisiana over the last 10 years, there has been one 404 permit denied by both the Army Corps of Engineers and the state of Louisiana. One, while the state itself is losing literally a football field of wetlands every 30 minutes, What can the Justice Department do to assure that the wetlands permitting process, the process of permitting that is occurring by both the state and the Army Corps of Engineers, is being done in a way that properly protects wetlands?
That's a really good question, and I in terms of what I can do or what the Environmental Crime Section can do, the answer is probably Not that much, except, and I think we have had an effect, in when you bring criminal cases, you do somehow give a greater confidence to regulatory agencies that what they can do, what they do, will be enforced. I think it's the most important, one of the most important functions we have, and that is to pump up the civil enforcement authority of the regulatory agencies whose orders and permits we enforce. But in terms, certainly the Rapanos decision has been a big challenge. I think
The wetlands in Louisiana that I'm talking about are not at all affected by Rapanos.
Yeah.
Not at all.
No, I recognize the problem, and basically, the only thing I can say is it's not something that, I need to have a permit, activity done without a permit, or a activity done in violation of a permit. I understand the context in which I operate.
I was at a national wetland policy conference this spring out in outside of D.C., and some of the new EPA and CORE people were there. And there seemed to be some renewed enthusiasm for, becoming more diligent as it relates to wetland regulation. I know that they have done a lot with mountaintop mining. I know that there are a lot of concerns, especially in the southern part of the U.S., about loss of wetlands. I would encourage people to, try to bring pressure on, the federal government. Obviously, the state government can develop capacity if there's a political will to do that. I know that in many other states, people say, well, that cultural revolution hasn't occurred here. I think it can, and I think it should. I think that, we have lots of evidence these days, from hurricane damage to water quality damage to flooding, that wetlands play an important role. One of the things I hope to do in my retirement is sort of, spread the story about, what we've been able to accomplish here. It's not perfect. I mean, we still have things that we need to do here. There's still agricultural runoff problems. There are, non-point source problems. We're still starting to see some people come into Wisconsin, and if you excavate a wetland and haul all the material out, there's no jurisdiction currently for that. We have a bill in the legislature that's going to be introduced in 2010 to try to deal with that. I'm an optimist. I think that these things can be accomplished, but I think it's going to take a lot of push from the people, both in the states and the federal government, to say, we really want this to happen. It can happen, and I think that from my perspective, the ecological evidence shows that it needs to happen in order to protect these resources.
Yes, sir. Make sure you identify yourself.
Sure. Sir. Ron Davis, I'm a reporter at Voice of San Diego. Question for Jeremy and you, Craig. Curious, just on an elementary level, databases that reporters should be looking for on this issue and red flags to be looking for other than chicken thieves watching out.
Part of the problem that we had in doing our stories that ended up resulting in our book was we filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Corps of Engineers for their database of permits, 404 permits they had issued in Florida, and they fought us for a year before they finally gave it up. And when we finally got it, we found out that the reason that they didn't want to give it to us is because most of it was blank. They were not tracking what they were doing because they were too busy issuing new permits. Obviously, that became part of the story, that the fact they weren't tracking, but that didn't really help us as far as figuring out where things were. I would say if you can, the thing that we found was multiple sources and overlay them and check them against each other. We got state permitting database, core permitting database. We got information from the National Wetlands Inventory, which even though the material was 20 years old, it at least told us where the wetlands had been, and stuff from some of our state agencies that we were able to overlay. By putting all those things together, piecing them together, we were able to figure out what the story was and basically kind of do the government's job for it and tell them, hey, this is what happened to all those wetlands you were permitting for losses. Are there any other databases you could suggest?
I'd leave it at that. If you're looking for databases to tell you about where enforcement actions are taken, I mean, so we issue press releases, but you may be talking about trying to find a story before it reaches my desk.
Right.
So I think that's good advice. And also, I mean, on a county level as well, there are all kinds of filings that have to be done, prior to development, and core applications often go out to public notice.
Let me add one other thing. One of the other problems we ran across is a lot of this stuff is not in a database. It's in boxes and boxes and boxes of paper files. And so it's up to you to go in there and put that into, a spreadsheet form or something where you can manipulate the data and figure out what it means and what the patterns are and that kind of thing. My co-author on the book, Matt Waite, one of his proudest moments, I think, is when we brought all of our database information and so forth and showed it to the folks from the government, and they said, wow, we wish we could do that. Yes, sir, in the back.
Frank Allen with the Institutes for Journalism and Natural Resources. I wanted to ask Jeremy, I happen to know from a reliable source that the Environmental Crimes Unit at Justice really can't go after all the cases it would like to. There just aren't enough resources, time, money, et cetera. So you have to choose which ones to focus your effort on. Is there any way for journalists to find out about others that you would like to go after if you had the time and people and so forth that might be worth looking into? Since you guys are busy, we'd be glad to help out.
And remember, this is your personal opinion, not the position of the department.
in the interest of full disclosure, I should also say that Frank knows the best source in the world, that is his son, who's a friend and colleague of mine, Josh Allen. Josh was the paralegal with whom I had the honor of working and trying that Lucas case, and he's in law school now and just finished up the W.R. Grace case, even while he was in law school in Montana. So, Frank, he's your best source, Frank. I mean, in terms of finding, we ask the same question. I mean, some of my best cases have come from, through investigators, but through somebody who called up. I've got to work on a wetlands case in southern Mississippi now. A woman who, her land was being flooded as a result of development in this area that nobody seemed to know about, although hard for me to imagine how the county official didn't know about it. But I've gotten calls indirectly from informants. Who have said all kinds of things. A case in the Midwest I did involving an air pollution case. So I guess you journalists know better than I that there are many, many diverse sources for good cases. Beyond that, I don't know. I mean, certainly I'm in that business too. I mean, I run around. I mean, my best source for cases, because I do sort of see myself as sort of a private attorney working for the government. I run around the country and try to talk to, my preference, because I was an assistant attorney general, talk to the state folks. They may tell me more than the federal people because they're right on the ground. They're out monitoring permits. They're the ones who are in the counties and know what's going on. So those are my sources. I go talk to them and say, and I can't tell you the number of times where I've gotten a call on a case and I've flown off somewhere and met the agent or the FBI agent or whoever it may be or regulatory person. I said, I just don't think that's something we're going to do anything about criminally. But while I'm here, why don't you tell me what else you have going on and have found things there? So you journalists know better than I that, investigation is often a process of indirection and dumb luck.
Yes, sir, in the blue.
I'm Dave Tenenbaum from Y-Files. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to ride through the countryside around here and presumably other places and see the barnyard in the stream. And I'm wondering if anybody would talk about the agricultural end of water pollution, which really, the chicken processing is one thing, but the fact that the cows are in the stream, essentially, is a big problem as well.
That's a good one for you, Michael, I think. the question, and I'm being reminded we need to repeat the question for the recording purposes, but it was a question about, would you say about the agricultural pollution and perhaps also non-point source stormwater type runoff, kind of thing? Yeah.
Yes, and regulation or non-regulation.
Well, I'll give the caveat is that that's not my area of expertise. I mean, I've dealt with wetland regulations, but I can tell you that that is an area of concern in Wisconsin, and I know lots of other places around the country. I know there are lots of things going on here, in Dane County where we live. They're trying to deal with developing manure digesters, and so that they deal with regionally. Places for people to bring their manure. As far as cattle in the stream, there are lots of programs going on to try to educate farmers and keep the cattle out of the streams, and that's been pretty successful in southwest Wisconsin, but there are still people who don't comply with that. I think like non-point source from building, I think that agricultural runoff is still one of the areas that hasn't been adequately dealt with. I think that's recognized by our agency as well as the federal agencies. Again, is there going to be a will to deal with that? I think we've seen some progress, but there are still there's lots of work yet to be done. But I think that those are issues that are constantly swirling around. I know in our agency.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll just add that a thing that journalism could do is to lay out the impacts of that kind of problem, and here in Wisconsin. We have lots of agricultural runoff and urban runoff, both of which deliver nutrients to not just to the water, but the water to the wetlands. And in this state, we have almost 500,000 acres that are dominated by a single invasive plant that responds really well to nutrients, and in particular nitrogen. So telling the story of what the impact of the nutrients is, I think it'd be very useful.
Let me just add one other thing. In Florida, we just recently had a legal settlement between the EPA and the Sierra Club and Earth Justice over setting numerical limits on just those kind of pollutants, the nitrogen and so forth, that were flowing in our waterways. The state had been supposed to do that job. They had been supposed to come up with numerical limits. They had been working on it for more than 10 years. And a big thrust of the suit was that the EPA had not been holding the state's feet to the fire to make them finish. And so as a result of that settlement, the EPA is now supposed to step in and do the state's job for it. The state folks were not very happy about that. And I mention all this because the Sierra Club folks said, we see this case in Florida as a template for pursuing this sort of litigation throughout the rest of the country.
You're going to have to cut here. We need room for another session.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much for coming. We really appreciate it. Thank our speakers.